This is a reading of a lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Child's Changing Consciousness and Waldorf Education. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on April 19, 1923. Between the ages of 7 and approximately 14, the teacher's main concern has to be directed toward the pupil's evolving life of feeling. It is really of great importance for educators to acquire the ability to create the kind of mental imagery capable of guiding the pupil through the tender transitional stages characteristic of this period. When the child enters school, remnants of the previous, quote, bodily religious mood, close quote, as I called it, still exist. There is still a longing in the child to take in through the senses everything that is happening in its surroundings, and this perceiving, which is transmuted into imitation, then links itself to listening to what comes from the natural authority of the teacher. At this stage, truth is not based upon the child's own judgment, but it comes in the guise of what the naturally revered authority of the teacher has to say. Similarly, what is considered untruth simply accords with what the freely accepted authority judges false. The same applies to what is seen to be beautiful or ugly, good or evil. Children will be able to develop the faculty of independent judgment in adulthood only if they have gone through the experience of looking up to the voice of authority with uncritical veneration. Of course, I am not referring to any kind of enforced authority here. The authority I am speaking of must never be imposed from without. And if in some instances an authoritarian approach is necessary for the sake of society in general, the child must not be aware of it. The child must always feel secure in looking up in total confidence to the authority of the teacher or other adult in charge. Everything has to come under the aegis of this tender relationship to authority from the day the child enters class 1 up to its 9th year, and particularly so during the years from 7 to 9. This relationship has to be preserved even longer, but between the 9th and 10th year, it will of necessity undergo certain changes. And now there's also another point belonging to this context, to which we must turn our minds. It is the fact that during the first life period, that is, from birth to the change of teeth, the child lived like one great multifaceted sense organ, but as a sense organ in which will forces were working in every instant of its life. For me to use the expression, quote, a sense organ in which will forces were working, close quote, may sound strange, but only because what contemporary physiology and the popular ideas derived from it tell us is totally inadequate. Today one does not associate will forces with the function of the human eye, EYE, for example. Nevertheless, even in the case of the eye, the perceived image is due to will activity. The same is true of the functioning of every other sense organ. Will substance is instrumental in creating the inner sense impressions. The task of a sense organ, first of all, is to expose itself or the human being in a passive manner to the influences of the external world. But in every sense organ, an inner activity also takes place, which is of a will nature. It is this will element which works so intensively throughout the child's whole body, up to the change of teeth. It also remains active after this event, and one of the consequences is that between school entry and the 9th year, this predominant will element in the child will tolerate only an entirely human and pictorial approach to external nature and to the human being. This is the reason why we introduce not an aestheticizing, but a thoroughly artistic element, especially in the younger classes. We do so by allowing the child to use liquid colors right from the beginning, even if this practice is quite likely to bring with it rather uncomfortable consequences in the classroom. We let children handle colors, because by putting them on paper one next to the other, not according to any preconceived notions, but simply out of an instinctive sense of color, and through the ensuing inner satisfaction, they are working in harmony with their own formative forces. When given this opportunity, children reveal a wonderful instinct for painting artistic color combinations, and these will soon show the teacher how to direct their efforts toward drawing with colored pencils, from which finally writing can evolve. But the one thing a child of this age is incapable of is following explanations. For this it has no understanding at all. If a teacher tries to explain his subjects during those first school years, the child will react by becoming blunted and dull. This approach simply does not work. On the other hand, everything will go with a swing if, instead of explaining one's subject matter, one casts the content into story form, if one paints with words, with mental images, and if one brings rhythm into one's whole way of teaching. If the teacher's relationship to music is not restricted to music in a narrow sense, but if they are able to introduce a musical element into their teaching, if their lessons are permeated by beat, rhythm, and other more hidden musical qualities, then the children will respond spontaneously and with an acute understanding. On the other hand, if teachers who introduced the world by thus appealing to their pupils' feelings were now to speak about the human being as a separate entity, the children would feel inwardly resentful. They would reject it. In fact, they simply could not bear it. What children really want during this stage is that everything they learn about, even if it is part of inorganic nature, should be presented in living human terms. The inner horror of facing a description of the human being, I think one can put it that strongly, remains with the child roughly until the 12th year. From the 9th to the 12th year, we can use as content for our lessons what I described yesterday. As long as we present it imaginatively, we can speak about the plant world in terms of hair growing out of the earth, and we can introduce animal study by showing how in every animal form we can see a part of the human organism, but specialized in a one-sided way. However, what we must not do at this stage is to make the human being the direct object of study, because the child is not yet ready for it. Only toward the 12th year does it experience a dim longing to gather together the entire animal kingdom in order to discover in the human being a synthesis of the animal world. This then can form the new content for the classes following the 11th and 12th year. For you to be told that teachers should relate parts of the human organization to certain animal forms before their pupils have reached the necessary maturity to study the human being as a separate entity may sound contradictory, but life is full of such apparent contradictions. It is nevertheless correct to proceed in this way, until the great moment comes when teachers can show their pupils how what we thus find, spread out all over the animal kingdom, is concentrated within one single human individual. To allow the child to experience such decisive moments in life really intensely is of great importance in teaching. And one of these moments is the realization passing through the child's soul that the human being seen physically is both the extract and synthesis of the entire animal world, only on a higher level. The inner experience of such a climb over a childhood peak, if I may use this comparison, is more important than the acquisition of knowledge, gained step by step. It will have a beneficial effect for the rest of the child's life. But because of the way our times have developed in an outwardly scientific direction, there is little inclination to look at human nature so intimately. Otherwise, things would not happen as they do in our civilization, and especially so in today's spiritual life. You need only consider what I emphasized already in our first meeting. Up to the child's 7th year, soul forces are working in all physical processes, reaching a certain conclusion during the second dentition. I have compared this situation with a solution that forms a sediment at the bottom of its container. The precipitate represents the denser parts, while a more refined solution remains above it. The two substances have become separated from each other. In a similar way, until the change of teeth, we can look upon the child's physical and etheric bodies as still forming a homogeneous solution until the physical is precipitated, leaving the etheric free to work independently. But now it may happen that too much soul substance is being held back by the physical body. Part of the soul substance always has to remain behind, for the human physical body has to be permeated by soul and spirit throughout life. But it can happen that too much soul and spiritual substance is retained, so that there remains too little of it in the upper region. The result is a human individual whose physical body is oversaturated with soul substance, and whose soul and spiritual counterpart has become too tenuous. This is a condition met with all too frequently, and with the necessary insight one can clearly observe it in children aged 7 to 14. But in order to do so, one has to be able to distinguish the coarser and the more refined constituents of our human organization today. What is essential for our society today is to develop a physiology that is backed up by a sufficiently strong psychology, and a psychology that is not abstract, but that is supported by the necessary background of physiology. In other words, one has to be able to recognize the mutual relationship between body and soul. Otherwise, the result will be a dilettantish physiology and an equally dilettantish psychology. It is due to this lack of ability to see through the human being clearly that contemporary scientific life has produced two such dilettantish branches of science, and the reciprocal effect between them has had the result of a squaring of dilettantism, or as it is also called, creating psychoanalysis. Just as a number multiplied by itself is that same number squared, so does a dilettantish physiology, when multiplied by dilettantish psychology, equal psychoanalysis. This is the secret underlying the origin of psychoanalysis. I am not saying this in order to cast aspersions upon psychoanalysis. Things could hardly have been otherwise, because due to our present-day scientific climate, society lives in an age where psychology has become too attenuated and physiology too dense. Seen in this light, physiology, instead of becoming a genuine branch of science, assumes the part of the precipitate out of what ought to have remained a homogeneous solution. This is only a picture, but I hope that you understand it. We cannot avoid the need for clarity about how the growing human being develops, and how we have to pay due regard to each particular stage in the life of the child. And so we find that between the 9th and 12th year, the child is receptive to everything that comes to it in the form of pictures, until approximately the 9th year, it wants to participate in the formation of the picture. It will not yet play the role of a spectator. During this time, teachers have to work with their pupils in such a living way that their joint efforts in themselves already have a pictorial quality. It does not matter whether actual picture making is involved, such as painting, drawing, or similar activities. All work, the lessons themselves, must form a picture. And then, between the 9th and 10th year, the child develops a new sense for a more outward presentation of the pictorial element. And this is the time for us to introduce botany and animal study in the appropriate way. Those two subjects, in particular, have to be presented pictorially and imaginatively. And the more one is able to do this, the better a teacher one is for the 9 to 12-year-olds, in contrast to what one finds in the usual textbooks on botany, where lack of imagery is displayed to a high degree. Portraying the plant world in its manifold forms with true imagination is most rewarding, because to achieve this one must be co-creative. This partaking in the creativity of the world is the very thing our present culture is waiting for. It happens again and again that people standing in the midst of life come to me full of despair because of their inability to grasp anything of a pictorial character. This shortcoming can be traced back to their childhood days when their needs were not adequately cared for. It is all too easy for the world to laugh at our saying that a human being consists of a physical body, etheric body, astral body, and ego. As long as one judges these matters only with the yardstick of customary science, one cannot help laughing. This is quite understandable. But considering the serious tangle in which our civilization finds itself, one would expect at least some readiness to seek for what cannot be found elsewhere. There are many instances of apparently inexplicable riddles. Of course, it is easy enough to greet with derision the following description of the human being. The physical body is born at birth. It develops by way of the body-bound religiosity, by imitation, up to the change of teeth. During these early years, the etheric body and all other forces are fully engaged in working upon the child's physical body. They are the soul and spiritual forces working in the child. The astral body is born only at puberty, to gain its independent existence from that time on. And as far as the human ego is concerned, this is something that can be spoken of with certain reservations only. The ego is fully born only after the 20th year of life. Although it may be wisest to remain silent with regard to this last point when talking to young adults engaged in their first years of academic study, it is nevertheless an unalterable fact. If one does not know the characteristic differences between the four members of the human being, one is likely to look upon their differentiations as being nonsensical, or at least as something highly superfluous. This, however, changes as soon as one has knowledge of the complete human being. You see, if we look at physical matter, we find its main characteristic in its exerting a certain pressure. I could equally well say that it occupies space. It presses upon other matter, pushing it. It also presses upon our body, and we experience this pressure through our sense of touch. Physical matter exerts pressure. The etheric, well, the nature of the etheric has a peculiarity of its own. During the last 40 to 50 years, it has appeared to natural science as rather a peculiar phenomenon. If one were to speak about all the theories that have been formulated regarding the essence of the etheric, one will be kept busy for a long time. This has already gone so far that a considerable number of people maintain that basically the etheric is the equivalent of the principles of mathematics and mechanics working in space and existing only as linear forces of some kind. To many inquiring minds, the essence of the etheric is not much more than differential quotients flying about in space, or at least something that is mathematically calculable. As you can see, a great deal of hard thinking has gone into the question of what the etheric is, and this in itself is praiseworthy enough. However, as long as one follows along these lines, nothing of real significance will be discovered regarding the etheric. What one has to know is that the etheric has the polar opposite characteristic of pressure. It has the effect of suction. It always has the tendency of expediting physical matter out of space, of annihilating it. This is the characteristic feature of the etheric. Physical matter fills out space. The etheric gets rid of space-occupying matter. It could be called negative matter, but in a qualitative sense and not from a quantitative point of view. The same applies to the human etheric body. Our relationship to the physical body and the etheric body is one where we constantly destroy and renew ourselves. The etheric continually destroys our matter, and our physical body builds it up again. This statement contradicts the law of conservation of energy, which is generally accepted today. I am mentioning this only in passing. But the fact is nevertheless that this law of conservation of energy is not compatible with the inner nature of the human being, and that it contradicts the truth. In the strict sense of the word, this law is only applicable to the inorganic realm. And with regard to the organic world, it is correct only as far as the iron particles in the blood serum are concerned, but not for the whole of the human being. For there a constant oscillation is taking place between the suction process of the etheric, whose forces destroy matter, and the restoration brought about by the physical body. The astral body not only sucks up space, but, strange to say, it sucks up time. It has the quality of leading backward in time. This will be clearer to us if we think of an older person's life. Imagine that you were, let us say, 50 years old. In your astral body, forces are always at work that lead you back to earlier times in your life, that take you back to prepubescent times. 50-year-olds do not experience their present age in their astral body, but in reality they experience themselves as 11, 12, 13, or 14 years old again. These past ages radiate back to them through the backward-leading activity of their astral bodies. This is the secret of life. In reality, we grow older only with regard to our physical body and with our etheric body, with its oscillations. The astral body leads us back again and again to previous stages of our life. Regarding the astral body, we are all still, quote, mature children, close quote. If we imagine the course of our lives expressed symbolically in the form of a tube, and we have reached this point, say, aged 50, then our mature childhood rays right into our 50s, because the astral body always takes us back in time. In the astral body, one always lives backward. But this retrospective life naturally begins only with the advent of puberty. If one can accept this fact in all earnestness, one will appreciate its implications with regard to education and give pupils content that will serve them for their later lives. Whatever one chooses to do with them would then be seen against the background of their entire lives, even if they should live to the age of 90. This awareness will endow teachers with an appropriate sense of responsibility. It is this feeling of responsibility, arising from the knowledge of what one is really doing, that truly matters. However, it can be developed only if teachers learn to recognize these hidden interconnections affecting human life. And if they do, they will not declare that the child should be taught only what it can fully apprehend. Such an attitude is really appalling if one considers the true nature of the human being and the textbooks and handbooks on pedagogy written under the influence of the object lesson mentality can lead one to despair. There the aim is always to come down to the level of the child's present stage of development and to treat all matters in such a way that he or she will see through them in every detail. This method deprives the child of immensely important values for life, as anyone can see who recognizes how childhood is related to human life as a whole. Let us take the example of a child who at the age of 8 has accepted something it could not yet comprehend, simply on the strength of its love and respect for the teacher, simply because what the teacher says must be right and good. Here love for the teacher, or sympathy, was the vehicle for inner acceptance. For the child to understand the matter fully might have required the maturity gained only at the age of 35 or thereabouts. It is not easy to speak about these things to a modern person, because people tend to refute the idea that only in the 35th year of life is enough maturity gained to understand certain matters. But the truth is nevertheless that one becomes mature enough to understand certain things, which one has accepted as a child out of love for one's teacher, only in the 35th year. At this age one again has experiences that are the outcome of the astral body's regressive forces. Something rises up from within, some kind of a mirror reflection, that in reality is a return to the days of one's childhood. It is like a rising up of an inner vision. One is 35 years old. One has become mature. And from the depths of one's soul there comes the realization, quote, Only now do I understand what I accepted on trust at the age of 8. This ability to understand what, imbued with love, has thus lived in one for many years has a tremendously revitalizing effect upon one's life. And this potential force of rejuvenation we can grant the child by safeguarding its inborn feeling for authority, so that it may become a vehicle of love and sympathy, and also by giving the child content it cannot yet fully comprehend, but that will gradually ripen during the coming years of its life. These interconnections are not recognized by teachers who bring to their classes only what lies within their pupils' present ability to understand. On the other hand, the opposite view is equally wrong and out of place. A teacher who knows human nature would never say to a child, quote, "This you cannot understand yet," close quote. One must never resort to this kind of remark, because it is always possible to clothe what one wants to say in an appropriate garment, provided one has established the necessary rapport with one's pupils. If the pedagogy we are here speaking of has become instinctive, one will know just what to say at the right moment. Above all, one will avoid sharply defined or rigid concepts. It is really dreadful if a teacher's ideas and concepts have been worked out to such an extent that they are no longer adaptable or mobile. They would have an effect upon the soul of a child, similar to the effect of iron gloves forced onto its little hands, preventing them from growing naturally. We must not chain children's minds to finished concepts, but give them concepts capable of further growth and expansion. We must give them living concepts capable of transformation. But this can be achieved only by an imaginative approach in all subjects, certainly up to the 12th year. And then the way of teaching I have sketched out for you so far will encourage you to use language creatively to help to draw helpful drawings on the blackboard or take up a paintbrush to make colorful illustrations of what you wish to impart. But there always has to be awareness that everything a teacher brings must be inwardly mobile and capable of remaining so. For one has to know that the approach of the 12th year, actually very close to the 12th year. Let me read that again. For one has to know that at the approach of the 12th year, actually very close to the 12th year, something new begins to develop, and that is the sense of causal connections. Before the approach of the 12th year, the concept of causality does not exist in the minds of children. They have an eye for what is mobile. They can get hold of ideas that are flexible, and they can perceive what comes to them in the form of pictures or music. But anything connected with causality makes no sense to them until about the 12th year. Consequently, this concept must be avoided at all costs until around the 12th year. We can reckon with a newly emerging understanding for the relationship between cause and effect. Only at that time does the child begin to have its own thoughts about various things. Previously, it saw the world in pictures, but now something begins to dawn which will light up only at puberty, and that is the life of thinking and the ability of forming judgments, which is closely allied with thinking. Between the change of teeth and puberty, the child lived mainly in the realm of feeling, and before the second dentition, in the region of the will, which, still far removed from the sphere of thinking, was intimately connected with the child's imitating its surroundings. But what at that time entered the child's being, quite physically, also contained moral and spiritual forces that became firmly established in the child's organism. This is the reason why during the 10th and 11th years, and in most cases up to the beginning of the 12th year, it is impossible to impart knowledge demanding an understanding of causality. From this it follows that one should not introduce pupils to the mineral kingdom until around the 12th year. Neither should concepts belonging to physics be explored before that age, although these have to be prepared for earlier on through the kind of imagery that bypasses causality. Anything relating to cause and effect in the inorganic world can be grasped by the child only around the 12th year, This is one side of the problem. We meet the other when teaching history. For before about the 12th year, it is impossible to awaken an understanding of the complex fabric of historical interconnections in pupils. Until that age, the teacher is well advised to give graphic descriptions of historical personages whose deeds, on account of their goodness, truth, and other attributes of greatness, will arouse sympathy, or in the case of negative qualities, antipathy in the children's souls. At this stage, historical content should appeal above all to the pupil's feelings. And this can be achieved by a judicious selection of historical personalities and happenings. These should present a complete story in themselves, which nevertheless should remain flexible in the pupils' minds in the sense already spoken of. Causal links between earlier and later historical events can meaningfully be taught only at the dawn of the regressive forces of the astral body, which come more and more into their own after the 14th year. At about the 12th year, the child enters this backward leading stream, and that is the time when one can begin to also appeal to a sense of causality in history. If this is done earlier, and closely connected with the concept of cause and effect, is the formation of judgment, one sets into motion something that can become very damaging in the life to come. For at first, there is only the child's ether body. Toward the 12th year, the astral body slowly begins its process of birth, which is completed at puberty. But the ether body was already fully developed before that. And if you ask pupils to form judgments, which always have a yes or no quality, or if you make them remember ready-made concepts, these will enter their etheric bodies instead of their as yet unborn astral bodies. But of what else is the astral body the carrier? As you can deduce from the facts of sexual maturity, the astral body is also the carrier of human love. Love is, of course, already active in the child before the onset of puberty, but at that time it has not yet reached an independent existence. It has not yet become fully born. And so critical judgments, with their attendant yes and no qualities, are implanted in the child's etheric body instead of in its astral body. On the other hand, if they are made at the right time, the astral body's power of love and benevolence becomes an integral part in the formation of judgments or criticisms. If you inflict upon the child the misdeed of forcing it to form critical judgments, of making it decide between yes and no at too early an age, you cram its etheric body full of these immature judgments. But the etheric body is not benevolent. It sucks up what is in its way. In fact, in this context, it is even malevolent. It has a destructive effect. And this is what you do to a child if you ask it to make positive or negative judgments prematurely, for a yes or no judgment always lies at the back of the concept of causality. On the other hand, an historical process complete in itself, or historical characters vividly described, can simply be looked at in the way one looks at pictures. But as soon as one links later historical periods to earlier ones, one has to make judgments. One has to reject or accept. And this choice always contains an element of yes or no. The final outcome of such premature judging in a child under the age of 14 is an inner resentment against the judgments generally accepted by society. If the power of judging is developed at too early an age, other people's judgments are not received benevolently, but with a latent destructive force. These things can show us the importance of doing the right thing at the right time. Bearing this in mind, let us once more compare the animal with the human being. You look at the animal's outer appearance. Its form is already indicative of all it does. We observe the animal's behavior. But when it comes to the human being, we have to look for the inner causes. And since the child becomes mature enough to look for causes only in its 12th year, this is the right time in which to present the animal world as a spread out human being, or the human being as the synthesis of the entire animal kingdom. This is an instance where the teacher is called upon to bring about an experience in the child that satisfies an inner demand and for which it is ready at this particular stage. But now you must admit that this marks a powerful reversal in the nature of the child between the change of teeth and puberty. In a certain way, the child's soul now proceeds entirely from within outward. Just recall that until the 12th year, the child could not bear to listen to a description of the human being, and now it is beginning to look at itself as the mirror of the world. And it does this conceptually, in the form of ideas. This new readiness for a portrayal of the human being, that is, of him or herself, really does represent a complete about-face of the child's nature between the second dentition and puberty. Within this same span of time, roughly between the 9th and 10th year, there occurs another very important transition in the child's life. This change can vary individually. In some children, it only happens after the 10th year. Each child instinctively, unconsciously, faces a kind of life riddle. This change of direction from within outward, this new awareness of being a self surrounded by an external world, whereas previously these two aspects were woven into one unity, is something the child does not experience consciously, but rather through inner doubts and restlessness, which make themselves felt at that time. Physically, the breathing becomes properly integrated into the blood circulation, as the two processes begin to harmonize and balance each other. The relationship between pulse beat and breathing is established. This is the physical aspect. Its soul and spiritual counterpart is a new kind of dependence of the child upon help from the teacher or educator. This appeal for help is not necessarily expressed by direct questions, but in a characteristic form of behavior. And now the teacher is called upon to develop the necessary skill in correctly weighing this great yet unspoken life question that lives in each pupil, though differently in each individual. What is this great question of life? Until this time, the child's natural sense of authority was the outcome of the teacher's image as the representative and mediator of the entire world. For the child, the stars moved because the teacher knew that the stars moved. Things were good or evil, beautiful or ugly, true or false, because this is how the teacher judged them. Everything coming from the world had to find its way to the child through the agency of the teacher, and this represented the only healthy relationship between teacher and child. But now, between the 9th and the 10th year, and sometimes a little later, the following question rises up in the soul of the child, not in the form of a concept or idea, but in a feeling way. Quote, "From where does she or he have all this knowledge?" Close quote. At this moment, the teacher begins to become transparent for the pupil, if I may put it pictorially. The child wants to see the world as living behind the teacher, who must not now fail to uphold the pupil's heartfelt conviction that he or she is rightly attuned to the world, embodying truth, beauty, and goodness. Here the unconscious nature of the child puts the teacher to the test to quite an unprecedented degree. It wants to find out whether she or he is really worthy of being the representative of the entire world. Once again, all this has to remain unspoken. If a teacher were ever to mention it or to allude to it by giving explanations or in other ways, this could only appear as a sign of weakness to the child, who in its present state of consciousness has not yet developed a sense of causality. For anything needing proof can only show weakness and inner uncertainty. There is no need to prove what is powerfully experienced in one's soul. The same is also true for the history of our civilization. I do not wish to go into details now, but merely want to give you a dynamic impression of it. Up to a certain time in the Middle Ages, people knew what the Last Supper meant. For them, there was no need for any proof. But then suddenly the situation changed, and this, when seen in the right light, only goes to prove that there no longer existed a real understanding of this event. No one would have need to prove that someone is a thief if the person in question is caught red-handed. Only if a thief escapes unseen must proof be found before he can be rightly called a thief. Proof is always demanded in the cases of uncertainty, but never for what the facts of life tell us directly. This is the reason why it is so comical when some people try to find the inner connection between formal logic and reality. This is almost as if someone were looking for the inner connection between a path leading to a mountain and the mountain itself. For the path is there to allow the wanderer to reach the mountain, and then the mountain itself begins. Logic is there only for the sake of reaching reality, and reality begins where logic ends. To be aware of these things is of fundamental importance. One must not fall into the error of wanting to prove to one's pupils, who are going through this important stage in life, that one is truthfully interpreting the world for them. Adjusting to the new situation in the classroom, one has to bring about a spontaneous conviction in the pupils that the teacher knows even more than they had previously imagined. The right relationship between teacher and pupil will be reestablished if, perhaps, while surprising a child with an amiable side remark about something new and unexpected, which will make it sit up and listen, the pupil feels, "Up till now my teacher has not yet shown this, her, true mettle at all. He, she, is able to reach quite unexpected heights." One has to save up some things for just such moments, so that the image of the teacher will continue to command respect. For the pupils to feel that their teacher is capable of growing even beyond the confines of his or her own personality, therein lies the solution to an important riddle of life. In this also lie the comfort and strength one must give to the child at this point, in order to not disappoint the hopeful expectations with which it came forward. For the child was inwardly longing to be reassured by the one person for whom it had already developed sympathy and love. And if this critical moment remains unheeded, teachers will have to go through the bitter experience of losing their authority and grip over pupils aged 9 to 10. Then they may well feel tempted to furnish proofs for everything they do, and this dreadful mistake will only make matters worse. If such a way of looking at education has become second nature, one will also find other helpful guidelines. But whatever is presented in class has to cohere, has to fit together. I have already told you that we let our young children paint quite freely, out of their own formative forces, naturally at first not with colored pencils but with liquid colors. This soon makes one realize how much a child lives in the world of colors. After a time, the young pupil will gradually come to experience in blue something distant, something that draws us away into far distances. It goes without saying that the teacher must have experienced this quality of blue also. Yellow and red appear to move toward the beholder. This a child can already experience quite concretely in its 7th or 8th year, unless it has been plagued with set tasks in drawing or painting. Of course, if you make children copy houses or trees naturalistically, this color experience will soon be lost. But if one guides the child so that it can feel, quote, "wherever I move my hand, there the color follows," close quote, the kind of material used is of secondary importance. Or, quote, "the color really begins to live under my fingers. Here, it wants to spread a little further," close quote. If one can call forth such feelings in the child's soul, one enables it to discover something fundamental and significant, namely color perspective. The child will feel that the reddening yellow comes toward us, and that the mauve blue takes us further away. This is how one can prepare the ground, in a living way, for something that has to be introduced at a later stage, linear perspective. It is very damaging to teach this subject before the pupils have had an intensive experience of color perspective at an earlier stage. To teach them quantitative perspective without their first having inwardly absorbed qualitative perspective inherent in the experience of color has the thoroughly bad effect of making them superficial. But there are even further implications. If you prevent a child from an intensive experience of color perspective, it will not develop the necessary impetus while learning to read, always with the reservation expressed yesterday that there is no need to rush the child into reading at the earliest possible moment. These color experiences will stimulate mobility in the child's mental imagery, suppleness in its feelings, and flexibility in its will activities. The child's entire soul life will become more sensitive and pliable. It may well be that the child learns to read more slowly if you use the method of painting drawing and drawing painting. But when the right time comes, reading will be anchored neither too loosely, as can happen, nor too heavily, in which case it is as if each letter were making a kind of scratch upon the tender soul substance of the child. What matters is that what is comprehended through soul and spiritual faculties should find its proper sphere within the human being. The question should never be, quote, "What is the point of teaching the child to paint, for she or he will never use it in later life?" Close quote. This would represent an entirely superficial view of life, for in reality the child has every need for just this activity. And if one wants to understand the complexity of a child's needs, one simply has to know something about the spiritual background of the human being. Just as the expression, quote, "You can't understand this," close quote, should never be used when talking to children, so should there never be a skeptical attitude among adults about what a child needs or does not need. These needs should be recognized as flowing out of the human constitution itself, and if they are, one will respond out of the right instinct. Nor will one unduly worry if the child forgets some of what it has already learned. For knowledge is transmuted into capacities, and these are of real importance in later life. They will not develop if you overload a child with knowledge. It is essential to realize and to apply in practice that one should imprint upon the pupil's memory only as much as is demanded by social life, and that there is no need, and that there is no sense in overburdening the pupil's memory. This leads us to the question of the relationship of the individual to the body social, to the national or ethnic background, and to humanity as a whole. When dealing with this problem, our aim must never to harm human nature when blending outer demands with our educational practice. The end of Lecture 5.